The force of her gaze must have been fierce enough for Michael to sense it. He glanced up at her suddenly and paled under Santan's dark eyes, and then looked away again hurriedly, almost guiltily. At Shaz's insistence, and over her objections, the family had acquired a controlling interest in the media company which counted amongst its assets the Golden City Mail newspaper. Shaz's motive had been to secure a place for Michael at the top of his chosen profession. His idea had been to build up the Mail as a powerful and conservative voice of reason, and for Michael, once he had earned his spurs, to take over as publisher and editor. That day had not yet dawned, and Michael was still only a deputy editor. If it had been left to Shaza, he would have pushed Michael earlier. However, both Gary and Santan had kept his paternal indulgence in check. The two of them had reasoned that Michael was not yet ready for the job. His financial and administrative instincts were underdeveloped, and his political judgment was naive, perhaps irreparably flawed. It was Michael's influence on editorial policy that continually nudged the Mail off the centre of the road, slanting it dangerously to the left, so that the newspaper had become distrusted not only by government, but also by the establishment of finance and mining and industry, those who paid for advertising space. On three previous occasions, the Mail had been banned by government decree, each time at a financial cost that infuriated Gary and with a loss of prestige and influence that made Santan uneasy. "He's not a true Courtney," Santan thought, as she studied Michael's pretty features. "Even Bella has more steel in one of her little fingers than he has in his entire body. Michael is a waverer and a bleeder. His concern is for strangers and for the losers, not for the family." For Santan, that was the most heinous form of treachery. "He doesn't take after any of us. He takes after his mother." And that was her most damning judgment. "He has even tried to corrupt Bella." Santan knew about the presence of her two grandchildren at the anti-apartheid rally in Trafalgar Square. They had been photographed by South African intelligence from the windows of South Africa House, and Santan had received a warning call from one of her important contacts in the government. Fortunately, Santan had been able to smooth things over. Bella had done some undercover work for South African intelligence during her passionate love affair with Lothar de la Rey. Lota had been a colonel in the police at the time, and he was now a member of parliament and a deputy minister in the Ministry of Law and Order. Santan had called upon Lota personally. She had enormous influence over him. There were secrets that involved Lota's father and other mysteries which Lota could only guess at. In addition, Lota had been Bella's lover, and Santan suspected was still more than a little in love with her. "I will include a full explanation of her presence at the rally in Isabella's file," Lota assured her. "We know that she's a patriot. She has worked for us before, but I can't promise anything for Michael, Dante." Lota used the respectful term of address, which meant more than simple aunt. "Michael has too many black marks on his file already, I'm afraid." "Yes," thought Santan grimly. "Michael has accumulated black marks, like a dog picks up fleas, and some of them hop off onto all of us." At that moment, Shaza finished his speech, and all of them turned towards Santan's end of the table, expectantly. As a speaker, she was every bit as good as her son, but there was often a little more of a sting in her words, and a little bit more directness in her views. They waited with anticipation for the customary fireworks as she began her reply. But tonight, they were disappointed. Santan seemed in an unusually mild and benevolent mood. Rather than censure, she had praise and appreciation for all of them. Gary's financial results, Isabella's academic achievements, Holly's architectural plans for the new Courtney Luxury Hotel on the Zululand coast, and her forthcoming birthday. "So sorry you won't be able to stay over with us for the big day, Holly darling." Even Michael came in for praise, albeit much fainter praise, with the publication of his most recent book. "One doesn't have to agree with your conclusions, always the solutions which you suggest, Mickey dear, to appreciate just how much thought and hard work went into the writing of it." When she asked them to rise and drink a toast to our family and every single person in it, they responded with gusto. Then Shaza came to the head of the table to take her arm and lead her through into the blue drawing-room, where coffee and liqueurs and cigars were waiting. Santan would never accede to the barbarous custom of leaving the men alone with their cigars after dinner. If there was anything worth talking about, then she wanted to be part of those discussions. Quickly, Michael crossed to Isabella as she rose from her seat at the table and took her arm. "I've missed you, Bella. Why didn't you answer my letters? There is so much I want to know. Ramon and Nicky." He saw her expression change, and his alarm was quick. Is something wrong, Bella? "Not now, Mickey," she warned him quickly. This was the first time they had spoken in almost 6 months, since Nicky had gone. She had not telephoned him or answered his letters. Moreover, she had avoided being alone with him ever since he had arrived at Felta Frieden that morning. "There is something wrong," Michael insisted. "Smile," she ordered him, smiling herself. "Don't make a fuss. I'll come to your room later. No questions now." She squeezed his arm and laughed gaily as they all trooped through to the blue drawing room and clustered round attentively while Santon settled herself in her customary place on the long sofa facing the roaring log fire in the Adam fireplace. "Let me have my girls with me tonight," she decided, and picked out Holly. "Come and sit this side, my dear." She patted the sofa beside her. "Bella, you on this side of me, please." Santon seldom did anything without good reason, and as soon as the servants had given them coffee and Shaza had poured cognac for the men, she played her high card. "I have been waiting for a chance to do this, Ollie," she said in a voice that commanded all their attention, "and I suppose your birthday is the best excuse I'll ever have. You are my eldest granddaughter, so I am going to establish a little family tradition tonight." Santon reached up behind her own neck and unclasped the necklace she wore and held it in her hands. A glittering treasure. Over 1,000 carats of perfect yellow diamonds. Each stone had personally been selected by Santon Courtney from the production of her fabulous Harney mine in the far north. It had taken 10 years for her to accumulate them, and Garrards of London had designed and manufactured the setting in pure platinum. "Something so lovely should only be worn by a beautiful woman," Santon whispered regretfully, and the tears that sparkled in her eyes were genuine. "Alas, I no longer fill that requirement, so it is time for me to pass them on to somebody who does." She turned to Holly. "Wear these with joy," she said, and hung them at her throat. Holly sat as though stunned, and everybody in the room was silent with awe. They all knew what that necklace meant to Santon. They knew that she had placed a far higher value on it than the mere 2 million sterling, which the Lloyd's assessors had recently decided was its intrinsic worth. Holly lifted her right hand and stroked the bright stars at her throat with a look of total disbelief on her delicate features. Then she choked and sobbed and turned to Santon and embraced her. The two women clung together for a moment before Holly could find her voice. It was muffled and small, but all of them heard it clearly. "Thank you, Nana." Only close members of the family called Santon that, and Holly had never done so before. Santon held her tightly, closing her eyes and pressing her face against Holly's golden head, so that none of them would see the little smile of triumph on her lips and the satisfied gleam through the tears in her eyes. Nanny was waiting in Isabella's suite.
"It's after 1 o'clock," Isabella exclaimed. "I've told you not to wait up for me, you silly old woman."
"I've been waiting for you for 25 years,
Nanny came to unhook the back of her dress.
"It makes me feel terrible," Isabella protested.
"It makes me feel good," Nanny grunted. "I don't feel happy less I know what you've been up to, missy. I'll run your bath. Didn't do it before, didn't want it to turn cold."
"A bath at 1 o'clock in the morning?"
Isabella dismissed the idea strenuously. She had not allowed Nanny to see her naked since her return. The old woman's eyes were much too sharp. She would pick up the tiny changes that childbirth had wrought on Isabella's body, the darkening and enlarging of her nipples, the faint stria where the skin had stretched across her hips and lower belly. She sensed that Nanny was becoming suspicious at this change of behaviour, and to divert her she said, "Off with you now, Nanny. Go and warm Bossy's bed for him." Nanny looked shocked.
"Who's been telling you scandal stories?" she demanded.
"Are you not the only one who knows what's going on at Felta Frieden?" Isabella informed her gleefully. Old Bossy has been after you for years. About time you took pity on him. He's a good man. Bossy was the estate blacksmith who had come to work for Saint-Anne as an apprentice 35 years ago. You go off and hammer his anvil for him.
That's dirty talk, Nanny sniffed. A real lady doesn't talk dirty.
Nanny tried to hide her confusion behind a prim expression, but backed off towards the door, and Isabella sighed with relief as it closed behind her. She went through to her bathroom and swiftly removed her makeup, tossed her evening dress over the back of the sofa for Nanny to deal with in the morning, and slipped into a silk bathrobe. As she belted the robe, she crossed her bedroom and then paused with her fingers on the door handle. What am I going to tell Mickey? If she had asked herself that question only 3 days ago, the answer would have been obvious. But since then, circumstances had changed. The packet had arrived. The last communication she had received from Joe Cicero had been on the day before she left London to return to the Cape of Good Hope. He had telephoned her at Cadogan Square while she was in the process of packing.
Red Rose.
She had recognised the husky wheeze of his voice instantly, and as always it had frozen her with dread and loathing.
I am going to give you a contact address. Use it only in an emergency. It is an answering service, so do not waste time and energy checking it. A telegram or letter addressed to Hoffman, care of Mason's Agency, 10 Blushing Lane, Soho, will find me. Memorise that address, do not write it down.
I have it, Isabella whispered.
On your return home, you will hire a post office box at a location not associated with Walter Frieden. Use a fictitious name and inform me at the Blushing Lane address when it is established. Is that clear?
Within days of arriving back at Walter Frieden, Isabella had driven over the Constantiaberg Pass to the sprawling suburb of Camps Bay on the Atlantic seaboard of the Cape Peninsula. The post office there was far enough removed from Walter Frieden for none of the postal staff to recognise her. She hired the box in the name of Mrs. Rose Cohen and sent a registered letter to Blushing Lane with this box number. She checked the box for a letter each evening as she returned from her office in Saint-Anne House in central Cape Town, driving the Mini over the neck between Signal Hill and the mountain, the more circuitous route around the back of Table Mountain, to reach Walter Frieden. Even though the box remained empty day after day and week after week, she never varied her routine. The lack of news of Nicky ate away at the fabric of her soul. The day-to-day events of her life seemed all a sham and a pretense. Although she channeled all her energy into her work as Shaz's assistant, the effort was not the opiate for her pain that she had hoped it might be. She smiled and laughed, she rode with Nana and at the weekends played tennis or sailed with her old friends. She worked and played as though everything was the same, but it was all acting. The nights were long and lonely. In the midnight hours she would resolve to go to Shaza and describe in detail the web in which she was enmeshed. But then in daylight she would ask herself, "What can Pater do? What can anybody do to help me?" And she remembered Nicky's swollen face and the silver bubbles streaming from his nose as he drowned, and she knew she could not risk that ever happening again. Strangely, the passage of time did not reduce the pain of her loss. Instead, it seemed to inflame her wounds, and the lack of news of Nicky aggravated them still further. Each day her suffering was harder to bear alone. Then she heard that Michael was coming down from Johannesburg to Walter Frieden for the trials, and it seemed fortuitous. Michael was the perfect confidant. She would not expect him to do anything except share her suffering and lighten the terrible load, which up until now she had carried alone. On the Friday before Michael's arrival, she had driven over the neck to Camps Bay and parked the Mini in the street beyond the post office. She walked back slowly and glanced into the side hall that housed the tiers of tiny steel postboxes. It was almost 6 in the evening, and the main post office was long ago closed. There were a couple of teenagers necking in the corner of the postal hall, but they scurried away guiltily as she glared at them. Isabella took the precaution of never approaching or opening her box while a stranger was in the hall. She glanced back at the entrance to make sure she was alone, and then inserted her key in the lock of the tiny steel door in the fifth row of tiered boxes. The shock was greater for the fact that she was expecting the box to be empty. Adrenaline squirted into her bloodstream, and she felt her cheeks burn and her breathing choke. She snatched up the thick brown envelope and crammed it into her sling bag. Then, as guilty as a thief, she slammed and locked the box and ran back to where the Mini was parked. She was trembling so that she had difficulty fitting the key into the door lock. She was breathing as hard as though she had played a long rally on the tennis court as she started the Mini, and you turned back across the road. She parked above the beach under the palms that line the drive. At this hour, the beach was almost deserted. An elderly couple exercised an Irish setter at the edge of the water, and a single bather braved the southeaster and the icy green waters of the Benguela Current.